beside me, and he started kicking him violently to see, to make sure there was no sign of life and firing. And he came over to me, and I just kept my face pressed down into the ground and pretended to be dead. I didn't, just didn't make a sound. I feel the same way, you know. I didn't ask to engage with the Troubles. Troubles engaged with me. I didn't make war on anyone. Britain made war on me. And what you didn't see in the documentary when you watch that is that, you know, there were other people there, not on camera, that were making sure that this was, you know, this was going to go a certain way. I spent Christmas looking at, I read 14,000 files from our case over Christmas.
Thank you very much for joining me, Stephen. I appreciate you taking the time. We'll get into the incident itself, the aftermath and so on. But can you give us a bit of an idea of how you came to join the band, and just like a bit of what your life was like previous to previous to this horrific incident? Like,
well, I was interested in music always. Props, because I was lazy, and it's something that I didn't have to work very hard at. The music came very easy. Played guitar for a while when I was a kid, from maybe about the age of, started to play guitar when I was about 11. But there was a lot of very good players around our area. I came from Carrick and Shure in South Tipperary, which is very south, as far south as you can go, on the borders of Waterford and Kilkenny. So if you're into sport, it was hurling country. The two great passions were hurling and music. And then, of course, with Sean Kelly came along, and he's a world champion cyclist. So cycling was big, and I was into cycling as well. The music was the easiest thing I ever did in my life. I couldn't believe anybody would pay me for doing it, you know. So as a guitar player, I was okay. I had very good technique, technically very good. But what I was playing on guitar, there was something that wasn't right. Couldn't figure it out until a neighbor of mine one day asked me if I'd consider playing bass in his band in a group. And all of a sudden, I discovered that what I was actually playing, no matter how fast I played, I was thinking like a bass player. So when I got the bass guitar and started to play with the band, it was like life changer, game changer for me. It was totally natural. And over the next few years, once I got to understand the role of the bass guitar in a band, I said my reputation grew. So I was big fish in a small pond around the area. And then I started to test myself, and I would go for auditions with bands, and I didn't even want the job, just to see if I was good enough to get them, you know. And then I'd say I couldn't take it or whatever, you know. And I was still at school. I went to after I finished. I had been playing with a few bands. I played with a couple of beat groups at the time. That I suppose today you'd call them rock groups or rock bands. And at that time, you would have had music. The popular music at the time would have been sort of like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Kinks, the Animals, John Mayall's Blues Breakers, all that type of thing. I was particularly interested in the blues. And I was also very interested in jazz. So in order to play in a pop band, you really had to get out of that mindset. You had to listen to what was happening. And there's no such thing as pop music. It's what's popular at the time. It's just like jazz. There's no such thing as jazz. It's what you feel at the time. So, even today, now I would encourage any young bass players or drummers, if they're watching this, you know, to for a while to play in what I always call a pure style. Country music is very good to teach you what what you, the role of the instrument. Reggae is also very, very good, and blues is very good. And they teach you, you know, where you should be in music. And then, of course, because country and pop and all of these things were popular, my reputation grew. And eventually I started get callings from offers to, you know, to join bands, pop, really popular bands, and turn them all down mostly. You know, I'd go and do the audition and then say I couldn't take it. And then Anne and I got married, and so I decided, well, I had better pay the mortgage. And so I decided, in my arrogance, I decided I'll join a big band. And so when the Miami offered me a job in 74, I went and I met them. And instead of offering me the bass player's job, they actually offered me the lead guitarist jobs, which I turned down. I didn't want it. As I say, two different animals, lead guitar player and a bass player, two different things. It's like, you know, getting a plumber to fix your electricity. It doesn't work, you know. So so they came back again the following year. That was offered me the first time the Miami offered me the job was in September 74. We weren't long married. And then they came back in May, at the end of May in 75, and I took that job then. I needed to pay my mortgage, which was £7 a week.
I'm sorry, remind me, what year were you born, and what age are you?
I was born in 51. So when I joined the Miami, I was 24. When they offered me the job the first time, I was 23. But I had been playing in lots and lots of different bands. I was playing in pop and blues and rock bands and all sorts of things, just getting the chops together. But the Miami was a big, big gig, and it was paying good money. And so, and they were fabulous. I think what people forget as well is that by the time I joined them, because that band was set up in 1962, 63, and I would have been about 11 at that stage. So, but they changed the personnel over the years. People left, and the band changed. And by the time I joined, they had dropped the name Showband. They were simply called the Miami, because Miami was in Ireland was a very valuable brand. At the same time, Showband was sort of old fashioned, and they had a great singer with them who had been, like me, he had been in the Beat groups, and called Fran O'Toole. And also they had a phenomenal guitar player called Tony Geraghty, who had been in a very heavy rock scene. People like Rory Gallagher and Gary Moore and people like that were big, big fans of Tony Geraghty's. In fact, Rory Gallagher gave him his AC30 amp. And Gary Moore never missed a gig when Tony was playing with the heavy bands. But like me, he wanted to settle down. He had been touring around Europe, and he wanted to pay the mortgage, get married, and that type of thing. So he joined the money, which is what I did.
I was going to ask you there. Okay, so you were obviously about mid 20s when you joined, and the troubles themselves, this era that you unfortunately ended up getting caught up in, I guess started about kind of 69. Yeah, 1969. So it'd been going about 4 or 5 years at this stage. For you, was it something you kind of had much awareness? Would it have been something you followed, you know, in newspapers or on the news? Did it feel like it was like a world away, or?
No, I had no interest in it whatsoever. Like so many of my of the people that lived in the Republic, I was happy in my ignorance. I was happy in you know, just that the north of Ireland may as well have been the North Pole, you know, and that is. That's the way we were thinking, to our great shame, you know, that we weren't interested in this. I remember when the troubles really started to kick off, I should say, 69, I was working in London, in the financial city, in what they call the City of London, which is the financial city. It's that square mile where all the business is done. And I remember when the troubles started to, at the beginning of 69, when they started to be reported on the paper and the news, and people would say, what's terrible, what's happening, you know, back home? I would say, well, you know, it's I'm a million miles away from that, you know, it's not happening in my, but little did I know that in 6 years afterwards, you know, that it would, I often think of what Malcolm X said when somebody mentioned Plymouth Rock. He said, my people didn't land on Plymouth Rock, like the people from the Mayflower, you know, that said, my people didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on me. Well, I feel the same way, you know. I didn't ask to engage with the Troubles. Troubles engaged with me. I didn't make war on anyone. Britain made war on me.
Well, sorry, was the band known for playing like all around the country? I know people, when you hear about it, you hear about it as a band that had no problem like playing to Catholics or Protestant audiences, but that would have just existed kind of in the north. Was it all around the country that the band used to play?
Well, first of all, the band was made up of Catholics and Protestants and from guys from the north and the south. There were three people. There was a six-piece band when I joined. Three of them were from the north, three from the south. The northern lads, there was two Protestant lads, Brian and Ray, the drummer and the trumpet player, and a Catholic from the north. And then down south, obviously I was Catholic, Fran O'Toole is Catholic, and Tony Geraghty from Dublin, who's a Catholic as well. But you know, I never knew what religion they were until after they were dead. It didn't matter to us. And I never once ever heard, we were based in Dublin, but I never once heard politics or religion or anything like that, you know, mentioned. And there was never a discussion about that. The closest it ever came would be, obviously, when I joined at the end of May. So we hit the ground running in June of 75, and then which brought us into July. And that's the marching season in the north, when the blood comes up, and you know there are people there. There are, there's a lot of very very sort of volatile activity there around that time. So the closest I ever came to hear anything about politics was when the lads would say, you know, if we're on our way to one particular place in the north, they'd say, we better avoid that town because there's a march on today, so we could get stuck in the traffic or something like that. Other than that, we had no interest, and where we played was, you know, to Catholics and Protestants. The one great thing about the bands, and we didn't know it at the time, was that we were actually peacemakers. Now that sounds sort of grandiose to say that. And we had no idea, we wouldn't have even known about the meaning of that word. But because we played to Catholics and Protestants, and because the ballrooms and the dance halls and the marquees that we played in would have had mixed audiences, which was the one place that audiences could go and leave the troubles and sectarianism and all that outside the door. And so it was an oasis for anyone. And also the thing is, you know, a young Catholic boy would see a young Protestant girl, or a young Protestant boy see a young Catholic girl, and nature took its course. And they discovered, you know, that people didn't have horns. You know, they weren't demons, and as they probably had been led to believe from their own communities. So we were doing something special, although we had no idea that we were doing that. Perhaps that was one of the reasons that sinister forces thought, you know, well, we'd better off without these fellas.
Okay, yeah, that brings us up to the famous night in question. Can you give us an idea of what it was like, maybe just your time in the band up until that incident?
Well, as I say, we hit the ground running in start of June, and it was different than any other band that I had played in. you know, obviously it was huge. I suppose because there wasn't the type of distraction that you have today, you know, that young people will have other things to do, and there's the internet, and there's lots of things. But at that time, you had one radio station, you had one TV station for the most of Ireland, around the north, and Dublin would, and down the east coast would have had maybe BBC, grainy BBC. But so going out on a weekend, or even any night of the week, especially in the summer, we would have been playing six nights a week, every week, sometimes seven. So it was a big deal. And also the fact that, you know, that again, the background to that industry was that they would put up, there'd be what they call festivals, really sort of marquee, put a marquee in the middle of nowhere, you know, in the middle of some townland. And down your way, you could, you know, you obviously you had the towns, the big towns, but some place around there, you know, a townland that perhaps with 40 or 50 people, they put up a marquee, start a, you know, have a carnival or a festival, and so all of the chair planes and bumpers or dodgings, whatever you call them, all of these things would be brought in. And a band like us, we could draw maybe 2,500-3,000 people into that marquee on a Monday night, Tuesday, Wednesday, any night of the week. So it was, you know, so not only were we playing the big towns, but we were also homogenous. We were drawing people out of the cities and the towns and into the country, and country people were meeting the townspeople. So it was a fabulous time, but there was, there have been famous bands of that 650, some great bands, legendary bands, that because for one reason or other, either they were playing just purely pop music, they wouldn't have been a big draw. They'd be a big draw in the cities, but not a big draw in the country, where people, you know, in the countryside, where people were more into dancing. So of all of those bands, there would have been a dozen maybe out of the 650 that were what you'd call 32 county bands, if you know where I'm going with this. So you're a band that could draw them in the cities, draw huge crowds in the countryside. And the Miami was one of those bands. They took a risk in dropping the name Show Band, but as I say, they wanted to, they had become morphed into this pop, really, really good pop band, excellent players. And when you consider there are bands in America, you know, like Chicago, and, you know, bands with one, a Scottish band called Texas. So a name like that wouldn't have been out of the ordinary at that stage. A name is a name. So we were, for me, joining that band, it was a massive step up. You know, you didn't have to do any work. You turned up, all your gear was set up for your everything. Just walked and you got a cup of tea or whatever it was, or we always got there maybe about 20 minutes. And the support band at that time, they used to call them the relief band, but a support band today you call them. And they'd have the crowd whipped up, and we walk on the stage, all the hard work is done, you know, and the crowd would go crazy. And it was like a dream come true, isn't it? For a young fella, for a young kid. As I say, I was 24 going on 14, you know, I was one of those type of individuals, just like the rest of them are.
On that note, do you remember the last gig you played with the band? What ended up being the last gig?
Well, yeah, we normally like to have one night off a week. It wasn't always possible because the band was very popular. And the night that you were most likely to have off was Tuesday, because on a Monday night you could be playing what they call the TV Club, which was a big venue in Dublin, in Harcourt Street, and that we'd have about 2,500 in there on a Monday night. we might play that once every, all of the top pop bands. That would be a very, very pop venue. So you'd have all of the young people in there. So the night that you're probably, as I say, most likely to have off is a Tuesday. But on that particular week, we had played the Monday and Tuesday at the Galway Races in a place called Salthill in Galway, which is over just outside Galway. It's a seaside resort. And there's a big, big venue there called Sea Point. And we did the two nights there. So obviously we weren't going to have Tuesday off. So they managed to, they told us that we would have the Thursday off. But we had to play in the north on a Wednesday that night in a place called the Castle Ballroom in Banbridge. And it was a fairly sort of short notice one. I think they only had a couple of weeks notice for that because there was a band called Kenny, an English band called Kenny, a very popular band that had some hit records out. And they pulled out of the north because of the Troubles. As far as I know, that was there. So the promoter that had that particular, was running that particular gig, was frantically looking around for a band that would maybe be able to keep that crowd. So we were the ones chosen for that, but it didn't matter to us. We were going to have Thursday off. And it was the a few days before had been our first wedding anniversary. Anne and I were supposed to have our, you know, go out for dinner or whatever it was. But so we put that off until we said we'll do it on Thursday when on our night off. But unfortunately, the night of the 30th in Banbridge, at the Castle Ballroom, was the last gig because the following morning, the 31st of July, was when the incident occurred.
Of course. You've probably... You probably been asked to recall it and go through it so many times, but would you mind taking me back to that night if you could?
Well, I won't go through any of the horror. I just you know, that's been covered, and there's the Netflix documentary. You know, we'll put that in context. But the interesting question always is, you know, why did it happen? Well, obviously. On our way back from the gig, one of our lads, our drummer Ray Miller, he decided because we had the following day off, he was going to go back to his parents in Antrim rather than come back to Dublin with us. And I always remember Ray always drove a BMW, you know, for he had this sort of it's kind of a yellowish BMW sports car. I can still see him heading off and. After the gig. And so there's five of us on the way back. Our trumpet player, Brian McCoy, he always drove our personnel van. We never traveled with the gear. The gear, the equipment was gone in another van. And so Brian kept the personnel van at home, and he was so he was driving that. It was lovely, beautiful, beautiful evening, or beautiful morning by the time we got out. And normally we'd be gone before the gear, but the ladies at the catering ladies in the hall that night asked us if we'd like something to eat. And because we had the following night off, Fran and I in particular, we said, yeah, we will. You know, talking to them and relaxing, and we knew there was no great hurry. And so we eventually got in. The gear was gone. Our roadie, road manager, was called Brian McGuire, and Brian had packed up quickly, got the gear in, and as I say, unusually, he was about 5 minutes ahead of us. So when you come out of that particular venue, you've got to cross over the road and then come down the main road. You cross over is like a road that goes over the main road, and then you drive down, and you had to come to a security barrier where the police would come, and every so often, and they would lift the barrier. It was to stop any terrorist activity. And then we got back onto, then turned around and got back onto the onto the main Belfast Dublin road, heading back home. At around, must have been around 2 o'clock, we were stopped on the way back by what we thought was a routine army checkpoint. We knew there were UDR people there. We knew the uniforms. And instead of just the normal thing would be that, you know, especially UDR, which was UDR was the largest regiment in the British Army, but at the time it would have been most of the people in the UDR, it stands for Ulster Defence Regiment, would have been locals, and a lot of them were part-time, as opposed to full-time British Army and the other regiments. And so those guys would have been well known to them, because, I mean, you know, normally if they stop you, they'd ask you for an autograph, or they'd ask you for and maybe if you had records or whatever it was, you know, and they'd be happy to meet you. But this particular time, we were surprised when they asked us to get out of our personnel van. And so, well, we did. They said they wanted to do a check, and Brian McCoy was, as I say, our trumpet player, Brian, not to be confused with Brian McGuire, but Brian said, he was almost apologetic, and he said, as we've got to get out, these gentlemen want to do a check on the van. And I had, it was new to me, but it was all a big adventure to me. I was a young fella from South Tipperary, you know. It was something that, like being in a movie, you know, you're a kid. And I was fascinated. I saw the guns, the people, the soldiers with the guns, and some of them were hunkered down, and they were actually very pleasant to us. We were told to stand at the side of the road with our hands on our heads. And again, I thought it was like something out of the movies. And I was in the center. There was five of us, and Tony Geraghty, our guitar player, was on my left, and on Tony's left was Fran O'Toole, our singer. On my right then was Brian McGuire, Brian McCoy, trumpet player, and on his right was Des McAlay, who was known as Des Lee in the band. And there was actually joking between them. They were joking with us, and it's hard to consider, you know, it's hard to conceive, like, you know, in your head, that these people knew what was going to happen, and yet they were able to joke. And while we were there, I heard somebody behind us, at the back of the van. We had a Volkswagen minibus, and they had lifted the there's a little back sort of panel on the Volkswagen minibus, because the engine is in the back of those things, and there was a little shelf at the back. So you could open that little sort of the half back window, and there was a shelf there. And the only equipment we carried was Tony's guitar and my bass guitar. And so I heard a click, and I knew somebody was opening my guitar case. So I wasn't taking this thing seriously at all. Yeah, I took my hands down, and I just turned around and walked back two or three steps. And I asked them to be careful with my bass. It was an unusual bass. It was a Dan Armstrong plexiglass, see-through, like one Kurt Cobain used a guitar version, but just a see-through, like a glass guitar. It was made from plexiglass. And I loved it. I didn't want anyone touching it, because there was only a few of those guitars. Mine obviously was a bass, but I had one, and Phil Lynott had one from Thin Lizzy, and Barry Devlin had one from Horselips and Wells. There was only a Brush Shields had one as well, Brush from Skid Row. And so we're kind of proud of the stuff. And so when I went back and asked him, Lucas said, can I help you with that? Because I don't want you to damage my guitar. And they weren't in any way sort of, you know, they weren't nervous or suspicious of my motives because they knew we were completely harmless people. And I pointed out, I had a little case beside it, a small old-fashioned school case, a little brown case. And they asked me what was in that. And I said, it was effects pedals, which is unusual again for a bass player because it's usually guitar players that use effects pedals. But I was using a wah-wah pedal and an octave divider, which split the two frequencies, the high and the low frequency. I was into the gear at the time. And and they were more interested. They asked me, was there any valuables in the case? And in hindsight, I suppose they thought that maybe the money from the gig was in it, you know, but we didn't handle any of that. That would have been gone with a roadie. And so I said no, and they tore me around and punched me in the back and knocked me back into line. But instead of knocking me into the middle, they now knocked me between Ryan and Des. So I was almost within, I was actually within touching distance of the back of the van. And then there was this other man appeared on the scene, and he was, without a shadow of a doubt, he was an English officer. Very posh.
He showed up in a car, I'm correct, right?
I'm not sure. There was a car came up behind us. Now, I don't know whether he got out of that or whether he was already there. You know, I imagine, because I didn't see him up until then, he may well have been in that car. I doubt if he had traveled with the others. And he took charge without a shadow of a doubt. You know, he was the one that started, he questioned the soldiers who appeared to be in charge at that stage. And and as I say, I worked in London in the financial sector, so I was well used to the various accents, and you know, whether somebody was from the East End or of London, or whether they were a posh, or whether they were, you know, the sort of, this guy had a very posh accent. He'd you know, I suppose you might call it educated English accent. And basically he changed the orders. The order at the beginning was to take our names and addresses, and he changed that to, he told them that he wanted our names and dates of birth, and that, which I believe now is the procedure. But I was fascinated with this fellow. I thought, you know, he looked almost like a comic strip hero, you know, one of the real deal. He had the fatigues on, slightly different. He had authority, he had a gun at his side and a sidearm, and all of the rest of the joking had stopped, and they were all sort of, now they were standing up and they were sort of doing everything more professionally. And when he arrived, Brian McCoy, who was beside me, he was now on my left since I had been knocked back into the thing. Brian said, nudged my elbow with his, because we had our hands on our heads, you know, like that. He nudged my elbow and he said, don't worry, Steve, this is British Army, we'll be away soon. And he actually used the word British Army. So this was not UDR. And I wouldn't have known the difference other than the accent. But the difference was that he would have been more professional soldier, and the UDR had a bad reputation for, you know, that they were, they could have given people, you know, a hard time or whatever. So Brian was convinced, and Des on the other side said the same thing to me. He said, don't worry about your gear. The British Army are usually very careful with the gear. So here were two fellows from Northern Ireland, Catholic and Protestant, telling me that, you know, everything would be all right because this was British Army. I was satisfied at that, although the punch in the back sort of made me a little bit sort of, I felt this wasn't right. But I wasn't really suspicious that there was anything seriously going to happen. And what I didn't know was, none of us saw, was that there was two men placing a 10-pound bomb of commercial explosives underneath the driver's seat. And for years, we thought that the thing had been put in the back of the van. It wasn't. It was being put under the driver's seat. And we wouldn't have known anything about that. And we would have, they would have said, thanks very much for your cooperation, and off you go. Nobody would have known about the roadblock. So we would have been down the road 10 minutes, 10, 15 minutes. Again, for a long time, we were under the impression that there was maybe a longer timing mechanism on it. But we now know from forensics that it was about 10 minutes. So we would have been in Newry. And at best, we would have been just over the board. Probably, in Newry. So going through Newry, this thing would have exploded. We would have been, forensics would have shown that there was a bomb on board. And we would have gone down in history as terrorists, carrying maybe a bomb for the IRA or transporting something like that. The frightening thing about that is that you know, I watched a program recently about Jerry Conlon, one of the men who was sentenced for the Guildford bombings, the scary thing is that obviously they spent what 16, 17 years in jail for something that they didn't do, but. There was a family called the Maguires, Annie Maguire, and they demonized these people because they were related to the Conlons. And they said that this woman knew about it, knew about these innocent men being terrorists, and they actually arrested her and her family, the Maguire, they called them the Maguire Seven, and one of them was a 16-year-old kid. So when I look back on it, I think my wife was only, she was only 21, who never knew anything, wouldn't have known the difference between the UDR and UCC, you know, just wouldn't know any of this stuff, that she would have, they would have knocked on the door and perhaps arrested her for being, for like they did to, and they would have arrested Fran's wife and Brian's wife, and probably even if you saw the documentary, you saw Fran's father crying, holding onto the coffin when he was being buried. They would have arrested that man as well, as you know, and called him complicit. So this is a horror.
And there would be, you would have like a life sentence of being known as terrorists in history. For all we know, there might be a different Netflix documentary. There might be a Netflix documentary about the band who was smuggling explosives for the IRA, and no one would know any differently.
Absolutely. But what happened, and I sometimes I reluctantly say this, but I swear, the truth is, what happened was, you know, it was just fortunately, was that while they were, these two unfortunate men were planting the bomb underneath a man called Wesley Somerville and another man called Harris Boyle, they were both not only, you know, UDR, but they were also UVF, Ulster Volunteer Force, because they were interchangeable. And the thing triggered and blew them to pieces. I mean, their injuries were horrific, blew parts of them out into the field, completely demolished the van. And as I say, we were close enough to touch it. And if you've seen any photographs of it, you'll see that it was little or nothing left. And when it went off, it was just a surreal thing, and it lifted me up into the air. It blew Des, who was beside me, and it blew him into the into the ditch, and there was a field about 3 meters below the road that we were facing with our hands on our heads. And he was blown down into the field below and into the ditch, where he managed to lie low. And I was blown up into the air, and it was like, I often describe it as, you know, the whole world turned red, and I was the everything sort of went into slow motion, and I felt I could think logically, like that I had all the time in the world to work this stuff out in my head. I could hear the gunfire instantly while I was still in the air. And then I started to fall down through the ditch and the bushes, and my sense of it was a heightened sensitivity. Now, whether that's adrenaline, I don't know. But as I went down, even through my clothes, I could feel every single leaf and bramble and twig as I fell down through the bushes down into the field. It was like I had time to count every one of them. And I in my head, I thought that these soldiers had been attacked and we were caught in the crossfire. That was the only thing that made sense to me. And I hit the ground really hard. And what I didn't realize was, I think that I had been hit in midair by what they call a dum-dum bullet. And a dum-dum bullet is specially designed so that on impact it explodes. It hit me in the right hip, exploded inside me. Part of it went through my left lung and out under my left arm. So it went right across my body. It exploded into 16 pieces. So I had a lot of serious damage. I said, and when I hit the ground, slow motion went to very fast and hit the ground very hard. And two other bodies fell on top of me. And that was, I think, can't be sure, but I think it was Fran and Tony. And they got up, and Brian, again, I can't be certain, but I think it was Brian, put his hands under my arms, and tried to drag me, but I was a dead weight. He dragged me as far as he could into the field. And but I was, as I say, I was a dead weight. I had been shot. I couldn't walk. And he was murdered. The soldiers jumped down into the field and started shooting. They jumped down instantly. And they shot Brian in the back and the head, in the back of the head, and he shot him in the arms. And so he was murdered within a few feet of me. And then they chased. They didn't have far to go. They chased after Fran and Tony, and they were just a few couple of yards away from us. And they murdered them. I heard them dying, begging for their lives. And you often see reports that Fran was shot in the face 22 times. He wasn't. He was shot 22 times, and 7 of those were in the face. But because that type of damage was enough. Once would have been enough to do awful damage, but 7 times is terrible. And the screaming and the shouting. The one thing that sort of I always remember was the obscenities. The cursing, the swearing, the shouting, there's the cursing of the soldiers. It was rage, absolute rage. And when everything went quiet, there was just some single shots happening, and it was this soldier walking around firing into the dead bodies to make sure they were, and then got over to where Brian was beside me, and he started kicking him violently to make sure there was no sign of life and firing. And he came over to me, and I just kept my face pressed down into the ground and pretended to be dead. I didn't make a sound. And I was waiting for him to shoot. At one stage, I considered getting up and begging for my life, but I'm glad I didn't. I just stayed quiet. And just as he was standing over me, somebody on the road shouted, "Come on, those bastards are dead. I got them with dum-dums." And he just walked away and he didn't fire into me. After that, after a while, then when they appeared to be gone, I heard a voice calling me. It was Des. He was over by the ditch. And he called Fran and he called Brian and Tony. There was no answer. And then he called me. And I answered. I just said, he said, "Are you okay?" I said, like, you know, it's almost comical when you think about it. You know, Irish people, they go into a restaurant, they get a meal that they don't like. And somebody says, "You know, how was that?" And they say, "That's grand, you know." And I actually said that when he said, "Are you okay?" I said, "I'm grand." It was like, you know, but, and then he left and he got up onto the road and he eventually got somebody to, there was a truck was stopped and truck wouldn't take him, thought he was perhaps part of something. And then there was a young couple in the car, and they brought him in and he reported it. And I was in the field for about an hour, crawling around and between the bodies and the body parts and all that. And it was, they wouldn't come into the field. The security forces wouldn't come into the field because they thought the bodies might be booby-trapped. And well, that's what they said. And then sent a helicopter in, and eventually they came in and they took me out. I suppose, I hope that's not too horrific, but it's, that's what happened.
Of course. Do you remember, it's been reported that there were 10 gunmen, and then the fellow with the posh accent came along making 11. Did it seem to you, does that number seem about right to you? Did it seem like there was about 10?
Well, I didn't see everybody who was there. I safely say I saw 5. But we're told that there was about 10. But the planning that went into this, you know, took certainly wasn't planned by the people that pulled the triggers that night. It wasn't. It was planned. It was a very, very, and this would be quite relevant now to somebody like yourself living abroad. You know, for a long time, we thought that, you know, this, the plan was to just simply to throw a cat among the pigeons and to say that you can't trust anybody. And so we better seal the border, you know. So if you can't trust anybody, we're going to have to do stop and search for everybody, because the Irish politicians, especially around the border counties, you know, Cavan and Monaghan and maybe Donegal, that they didn't want all of this stop and search, because their constituents, you know, living on the border would have been driving into the north. It should be like a quarter of a mile, you know, or a few yards going to the, and they get maybe cheaper cigarettes or cheaper petrol. So, you know, the nearest town or shop might be just over the border. So to have a stop and search would have disrupted their lives. So their TDs, their local politicians, or even national politicians would have said, you know, we really don't want that kind of disruptive thing happening. But the British were very keen to curtail the movements of the IRA, because the IRA would commit an atrocity in the north, and then they would cross the border to relative safety. And when I say relative safety, I mean, there wouldn't have been that many checks, because in the north, you could be on the road 2 minutes and you'd have some, you know, it could be a Scottish regiment, British regiment, could be UDR, whatever, would, you know, you could be liable to be stopped. That really wasn't the case in the south. So in order to have strict security, this would have worked if they had framed us, because they would have said, who can you trust? And I thought that was about the size of it. But I spent Christmas looking at, I read 14,000 files from our case over Christmas. And
Christmas,
just gone. Yeah. I eventually got the the case files, because as you know, we took a case against the British government. And I'm convinced now that it was a much more ambitious plan, that somebody like yourself or anybody living abroad, because as you know, there would have been a lot of sympathy for the Republican cause in America and in other countries. And so not only would they have stopped people crossing the border, but they would have stopped people crossing any border, whether it was, so being an Irish person, they would have sent out a message to all of their embassies and to all of the other countries and other governments and said, sorry, but we really have a legitimate reason for stopping every Irish person and checking their passports and finding out. So it would have been incredibly disruptive to every Irish person living abroad on the planet, never mind crossing any border. So at airports, you would have had border crossings throughout Europe as well. I mean, one country into another. And it would have been a very, very convincing argument, you know, to say, look, their most popular pop group were at this. So we can't take any risks. So today you would be like a Palestinian. You come to the airport, you're going to be singled out and you're going to be hauled aside and asked where you're from. They'd take every single detail. So it was, and you saw how easy that was to do and the way they were able to lock people down during COVID. So it's not beyond the wit of man to say that this would have worked and worked very well. We've seen it working when foot and mouth disease happened and there was border checks, and you and I would if nobody knew about that checkpoint, and if looking from an objective point of view, you'd say, well, the good reason for stopping. If these fellows were at it, there's a reason. Because when you consider the Birmingham Six, you consider the Guildford Four, you consider the Maguire family, the newspapers, not just in Britain, but the newspapers in Ireland and everywhere else were saying, let them rot in jail. So the propaganda kicks in and all of these things are... you believe what the likes of Murdoch and people like that put on their newspapers. So this is why I say fortunately, and thank God, that two of us lived to tell the truth about this. And we took a case against the British government, because there was never any solid... when you go to court, you have a very solid evidence, and there was a British set up this thing called the Historical Inquiries Team, the HET, and that was made up of British detectives, and they looking into troubles between a particular period, and we fell into that period, and the report was strong enough to say that there was collusion in our case between the security forces and the Ulster Volunteer Force, which was a terrorist organization, although at the time it wasn't prescribed. And so it gave us enough to take the case. And we thought that this case, according to our solicitor in Belfast, this case should have taken 18 months to 2 years. But they dragged their feet on it to the extent that it took 9 years to get them into court. And they have this obscene bill now called the legacy bill that's going through, and they think it'll be passed this week.
Legacy and reconciliation.
Yeah. Well, the word reconciliation is an abomination when if it's in any way connected to this legacy bill, which is simply a cover up. But and they say that they want to speed up the process of people getting truth. It's a complete lie It's a lie, because the reason that these court cases haven't progressed is because, as is evident in our case, they refuse to give. You have to drag every single thing from them. You have to go through process of getting, in any case, get discovery and then specific discovery evidence. And even the judge that was dealing with our case during the process of trying to get them into court had to reprimand them and say, you know, this is outrageous that you're not, we've ordered you 18 months ago to hand over these documents. And this, they pay no attention to them. They have no respect for the judiciary. But we eventually got them into court. And they offered, when they knew there was no way out, they offered a settlement, and I refused. And they said that it had to be, although there were four separate cases, that was Fran's wife, Brian's wife, Des, and myself, four separate cases. But they said, strangely, we have to settle all four cases or else we're settling none. And because my initial, when I was told that, my initial response was, well, let the others settle, because if they want closure, they're not young anymore, and not that I am young myself, I'm 72 now. But when, you know, I said, I want to fight my case. And they were offering this settlement and payment. And but I turned it down first, and then even up to about 2 weeks before it went into court, I still turned it down. I wanted the case heard. But the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Brendan Lewis, was on the paper saying that they're going to get this legacy bill, which closes down all cases, closes down all even civil cases and inquests. And he was threatening to get that over the line by Christmas. And we were due to our court case. Our court date was December the 13th, 21. And so there was a danger that, you know, if had there been a delay for whatever reason, it could have been, you know, somebody ring in and say, well, we've COVID, we have to put it off for 6 months, whatever. But they were saying that, you know, if this happens, your case won't be heard at all. So there'd be no satisfaction whatsoever. And what you fought for the last. So effectively what they did was they blackmailed me, and they said, you know, you'll be the cause of the others not getting any closure. So I reluctantly decided, you know, it's better than nothing. And I agreed to settle. But when I came out home, all the TV cameras and all of those are the usual thing, are all there. And I let my feelings be known. I said, they were afraid to fight us in court, and they forced me to take this. I had no choice. But either way, you know, they settled, and they gave us this payment. And that in itself is an admission of guilt, you know. But officially, they said that they were settling without an admission of liability.
If I could take it back a small bit to instantly after the night in question, I suppose it would have been on the topic of collusion. I suppose it would have been obvious straight away that there was some element of collusion, given it was a British Army regiment and so on. But was that like was that in your mind? Like in the weeks and months after, did you feel like you'd been a victim of collusion, or was it just the case you felt maybe a victim of the UVF?
I didn't know the meaning of the word collusion. I think I was completely and totally, you know, ignorant of all of these terms. I knew nothing about it. For years and years afterwards, you know, I didn't see the relevance of a British Army officer in charge of that operation. I thought that a British Army officer might come along, and just because he'd be more senior, be overseeing an operation by the UDR. So I didn't understand that. And when I brought it up in the preliminary trials, I think it was the year after or whatever, when the first two people, Crozier and McDowell, were in court for the murders. I remember saying to the barrister, who's apparently supposed to be on our side, the prosecution, I said, "Will I mention the English officer?" And they said, "Don't. It's not important." And I didn't even question that. But just later on, when you begin to look at the bigger picture, but to be honest with you, John, you know, I didn't want to believe in collusion. I didn't want to believe that the security forces would do that. I wanted to believe in the rule of law. This is why I say, you know, that when you go back to when I was young and you go back to that, we were happy in our ignorance. And I think, you know, it's something that it's a great regret, but that's the way we were brought up. You know, we turned our backs on our nationalist brothers and sisters in the North. Now, I don't want to relive the Civil War again, because, I mean, that's for academics. But the Civil War happened and the partition happened. And there wasn't a whole lot anybody could do about it at the time. There's, you know, there's a threat of a terrible war by Britain. So either way, whatever way, you know, you come down on that. But there were times that we just left them. You know, we walked away, turned our backs on them. And even though you had this famous, you know, this is a Protestant state for a Protestant people, surely we should have, you know, we should have said, hold on a second, we need to ensure that these people are treated properly, you know. But so today, I give the Arthur Griffith lecture in Cavan County Museum there a few months ago, and it was one of the things that I brought up, that, you know, we talk about reconciliation, and I'm part of a group called Truth and Reconciliation Platform. You can go on to tarp.ie and you'll see that, you know, we work with people, victims from all the communities, and I hope we're even handed. But you know, when it's one of the things that when I at the Arthur Griffith lecture, that has become pretty obvious to me now, is that we use the word reconciliation out of context, because, as you can see, we call the group Truth and Reconciliation Platform. But my experience since 2016 working with TARP is that reconciliation, and this is open to debate, but to reconcile with somebody is to, you know, to come back together. I mean, that's how I see the meaning of the word, you know, to reconcile is to bring people together again. Well, there was never a time when the nationalists and unionists were together. They were never singing from the same hymn sheet. They were never, so the word reconciliation, I don't think is appropriate. I think the appropriate word would be to resolution, really, to resolve the problems, you know, that exist between the two communities. And they're great people in both communities, and the communities suffered terribly. You know, nobody has a monopoly on the suffering or the loss. But having said that, you know, I think we should try to work towards a resolution of the problems that have existed. But reconciliation, as I said at the time, is not redundant, because the reconciliation, the unspoken reconciliation, really, that we have to work at is the reconciliation between the Northern and Southern nationalists, because there's a lot of hurt there. There's a lot of suspicion there. There's a lot of things that need to be talked about that's not talked about. And because if we're heading for a united Ireland, which I hope we are, I think it's good for everybody, because Northern Ireland, as it stands, is a failed state. I mean, and it's irretrievable for Britain. You know, there's no way that it's ever going to go back to being what it was before. I believe any United Ireland will come about through a consensus. It has to, but it'll be brought about by people, young people, regardless of religion or politics. Young people trying to put a roof over their head, or get a mortgage, or to feed their kids, or educate their kids, and look after their families. And whoever offers the best prospects for these people are the ones that it will. Whether the union is maintained or whether there's a United Ireland, it'll be decided by young people like that who are looking to the future. But in the event of a closer political relationship between the North, and as you can see, perhaps Sinn Féin are the most popular party at the moment. But unless the problems and the suspicions and the hurt is addressed and talked about, and discussed, and people see, people understand the past. It's not just enough to know it; you must understand the past. Unless we do that, then the coming together of any kind of coalition would be dangerous and toxic. So we need that type of discussion. That's what I believe, but I'm not a political animal. But I'm pragmatic. I think that's something that needs to be looked at. It's just like understanding why people did things. People are often surprised when I say, I understand why one person kills another person. I understand why I was shot. I understand why there was anger there. I understand. I'm not agreeing with it. I mean, who? Going to be out of your mind to say, that I agree with somebody shooting me or killing the lads, but I do understand why these things happen. It's like a virus. Unless you understand the virus, you can't get rid of it. So the toxicity that exists in society that continues to poison society, it needs to be taken out. And as I say, like a virus. Unless you understand it and you try to understand it, and there's dialogue, then you can't even begin to eradicate it.
Right. I was going to say there's a big difference between understanding something and excusing it. You know, I mean, and justifying. I mean, you can, like, you can read history and you can understand why the German people went on the route they went in the 30s and 40s, but not justify it. Yeah,
absolutely.
A big difference. I wanted to ask you there, like, in the months, weeks, and decades following the attack, was there a part of you that had a desire to know who it was, as in who the members who were there on the night are and the people who planned it? Was it something that made a difference to you at all, just knowing who it was, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, for years afterwards, one of the things that stopped me thinking like that was the fact that I wanted to put it out of my mind. I thought, you know, that if I did that, if I just did what a lot of people very arrogantly say today, you know, put the past behind you, look to the future and move on, which is the most ridiculous thing you ever heard. But at the time, I was inclined to think, you know, that this is possible. If so many people are telling you, you know, put it behind you, move on, but it's as mad to say that to somebody as it is to say to somebody with terminal cancer, you know, put it behind you and move on. You know, you can't do that. And the trauma that's been experienced by people on both sides, by people, and we deal with, engage with people who have been through terrible, terrible trauma. You know, co-founder of our group is Eugene Reavy, whose three brothers, innocent young men, were murdered in White Cross on the 4th of January 1976, watching television, these people just came in and slaughtered them. The following night, I think it was the 5th of January, the following night, the 6th of January, their neighbors were murdered at Kingsmill when they were slaughtered coming home, 11 people, 10 of them Protestants and one Catholic, and just slaughtered just down the road from where the Reavies thing happened. And so Joe Campbell, whose father was one of the sort of rare enough Catholic policemen trying to do a good job, RUC man, went to join the guards, and then there was an embargo on the guards who weren't recruiting. So himself and his brother, ever before the Troubles went, took off, just said, well, what the hell, we'll join the, we go up north and join the, they were living in Monaghan, I think it was, and went, joined the RUC, didn't think, and then the Troubles broke out. And he reported, he was a good policeman, in very popular with everybody when he was stationed in Cross Midlen, and they were moving up to Cushing Dal. There was a 1,000 signatories collected to keep him in Cross Midlen. He was so popular, such a good man. And when he moved up to Cushing Dal, he discovered an illegal importation of arms by loyalist paramilitaries. And he reported it to his superiors. And instead of acting on that, they sent out their people, and they murdered him for that. So, you know, Joe's father was just one of these really good people, and he was shot in the back of the head, murdered. So we deal with and engage with people all the time. Joe's a very, very important member of and driving force behind TARP as well. But, you know, the list is endless. Yeah, the list of awful atrocities. People, you know, like McGurk's Bar, who they succeeded in framing those people for years, and now the truth is coming out. People like Kathleen Gillespie, the IRA held her hostage, and because her husband had taken a job as a cook to feed his family, he took a job as a cook in an army barracks, nothing to do with any politics, and they chained him into a car and made him, told him that they'd kill his family if he didn't drive down to an army checkpoint. And when he got there, he opened the window and shouted, "Run, I'm loaded." And, you know, Kathleen Gillespie, I know her very well, good, decent person, Catholic family as well. So, you know, this makes it all the more, you know, ironic that the IRA should do this. But I remember talking to Kathleen one day, and she said, you know, she said, "I'm not the only one ever to lose a husband in the Troubles." She said, "My problem is that we couldn't find any part of him to bury when the bomb went off in his car. And what they buried was a small piece of skin hanging off a bush attached to a zip." So, you know, it's all very well for people to look back at the Troubles and say, you know, it was a glorious war, whatever side you happen to have an empathy with. It wasn't. There was nothing glorious about it. Even when I speak to the paramilitary organization representatives that murdered our lads and shot me, even they will say nothing glorious about it. It was terrible. And yet you've got these youngsters who are keen to get stuck into this fighting again. God help them. As I say, it's important that the voices of the people that we work with in TARP, the voices of the victims, the voices of the perpetrators, the voices of all of the voices, even those from the grave, that they're heard. Because unless they are, we make the same mistake again, and we use violence as a political expedient or as some way to change society, when John Hume told us that we now know that it's a far better way to do it. It's through politics, it's through making whatever aspiration you have, make it more attractive than the aspiration the other person has, so that you can convince people that, you know what, a united Ireland is the right thing to do, or union is the right thing to do. But from my own, in my own opinion, I think that a united Ireland would be far better for everybody.
Of the 10 that were there, I think it's accepted that, okay, obviously the two who were killed by their own bomb, Wesley Somerville and Harris Boyle. They're obviously confirmed. There was someone named Thomas Crozier. There was also John Somerville. Have the other members have their identities come to light, and especially that of the posh accent guy?
Yeah, well, of the names you mentioned, there was also Shane Roderick McDowell, so he was convicted as well. I've never been able to identify the soldier. Now, the other survivor maintains that it was Nairek, but even in the court, I wasn't able to identify in the people in the dock. I just don't have great a great memory for faces. Now I'm told that is probably a result of the trauma, because what I saw in the field was horrific. Because as I said, I was there for an hour, and it was a moonlit night, so what I saw is not wasn't great. Having said that, yeah, Nairik, Captain Robert Nairik is his he was accused by his own people serving in the security forces with him have made a statement saying that he's the one that planned and executed the Miami incident. But since we've also been told, because the description that I gave of the officer that I saw, I thought he had more fair hair than the pictures I saw of Nairik. But so I've never been able to say, but there have been, reports to us that there was more than one British officer there, that there was actually two plus a driver and somebody else. But it's unsubstantiated, so I don't know. I can't say for sure, but I also believe that there was apart from the people who were that we know died at the scene, I think there was at least another one person, but don't have evidence of that yet. That was taken away before there's any report done.
I see, I see. It's also been reported that there's a very. I just spoke to my last interview was with a lady named Anne Cadwalder,
Oh,
who
I
wrote.
know her. Yeah, I know Anka. I know Anka.
Yeah, very nice lady. Wrote probably the leading book or one of the leading books about British collusion with loyalist paramilitaries. And we spoke mainly about the Glenning Gang. One of the members, one of the more infamous loyalist killers, was a fellow named Robin Jackson. And it's been rumored and alleged that he was there on the night. Have you heard anything, even unofficially,
Oh,
like
no,
that?
he was there. He had just taken over that particular group of UVF people. The person who was the leader of that group shortly before him, who was murdered by themselves, was a man called Billy Hanna. And Billy Hanna was involved in the Dublin and Monaghan bombings, and he was also in when one of the very interesting things about our documentary when we made it with Netflix was that there's a section that people, sometimes don't see the relevance of. But one of the former head of a special branch is a man called Raymond White, and he is in the documentary, and he actually says in the documentary, he says, "I believe that the same people who were responsible for Dublin and Monaghan were responsible for the Miami Showband killings." Now, I have no doubt about that whatsoever, because I believe Jackson was involved, and Jackson was involved in the killing of Joe Campbell, the man that I mentioned, Sergeant Joe Campbell. He was also involved in the killing of William Strathairn, a decent man who opened the chemist shop, because he was told that there was a sick child, and Jackson was there, and Jackson shot him dead. And when it went to court, and Jackson wasn't in court when they were when McCaughey and John Weir were on trial, policemen. And when the question was asked in court why Jackson wasn't there, the answer given to the judge was for operational reasons. And this was given by a senior police officer. So how do you say that somebody who was, suspected of doing this, which he did kill William Strathairn. How can the judge accept that? He's not here for operational reasons. Just let it go like that. So massive collusion. Robin Jackson, undoubtedly, is the linchpin for all of this. If you nail Jackson, and there's plenty of evidence there, but of course the British wouldn't they wouldn't cooperate with the Baron Tribunal. They wouldn't cooperate, as I'm sure Anne Cadwalader would have told you all that. But they don't cooperate. Unfortunately, you know, it's difficult to get all of the files and the evidence, and that's why they're shutting down these cases. That's why this legacy bill is being pushed through. It's not, definitely not, to protect their soldiers, the British soldiers, because they've used those for 600 years as cannon fodder. It's to protect the people who gave the orders and made these brilliant plans. Because, you know, and when you look at it, had they pulled off the Miami one, had they successfully framed us, it would have been a brilliant result for them. But it begs the question, how many others did they manage to frame as well?
The ones that we'll never know about. You mentioned there about going through case files during Christmas just passed. Like when you look through these, I assume that this is information that isn't like publicly available. And when you look through these, how do I say it? Like how do you come to the conclusion that the people higher up knew about it? Like what is in the files that would indicate?
First of all, they managed to the only way I could get the files was that I said that, you know, that I wouldn't use them and that I wouldn't know. That may, you know, we may be able to appeal that. So I can't tell you what's in the files. I can't say that. But without a shadow of a doubt, the people who carried out the Miami incident and carried out the Dublin and Monaghan bombings and a number of others, the trigger men, the people who pulled the trigger and were there, they were not capable of operations this complexity, without a shadow of a doubt. And it is worth reading Anne Cadwalader's book. It's called Lethal Allies. My book, the one that led to the Netflix documentary, is much more personal, because it, you know, I'm not expert on other cases. But what I am at this stage is I am expert on my own case, you know, only because I've done the research, but also because of the research that was done by people like Justice for the Forgotten and Patrick Lucan Centre and other people that, you know, there are some very good writers and people who've researched this. I remember I was giving a talk in Phoenix in Arizona one time. It was because of the Netflix documentary, which rose our case into, you know, international prominence, and it's probably the most viewed film ever made of the Troubles, when you consider that, you know, that it was Emmy nominated on Netflix, and it was along with that, then it was trended twice or three times, you know, all over the world. So I remember giving the talk in Phoenix, and there was this man, just clearly he wasn't Irish, and just looking at me, you knew he wasn't Irish, you know, this man knew more about me than I did. You know, he stood up to ask a question. And I get this, you know, all the time, that there are people, you know, who are, and they do objective studies, people who have no axe to grind, you know, they're just interested, and they're academics from all around the world, and they get in touch. It's the reason that I'm here talking to you today, is because what we need is information, education, more than anything else. You know, it's not about me anymore. It's not about, you know, but information and education, so as that people You know, we are a counter-radicalization group who will tell you, you know, well, you know, things have to change, but violence is not how to do it. And that may not go down very well with some people who believe that there was some kind of a glorious war there, but it just isn't, because anybody who, you know, who thinks that they're, you know, that by supporting a violence or an armed struggle, if anybody thinks that, they're completely, you know, they're living in another world, because violence, all it does is makes people on either side of the political divide go back into their own enclaves and entrench. So it would put back, if somebody thinks that by supporting violence is going to get you in a united Ireland, well, they're wrong, because it would put back the unification of Ireland by 50 years if the trouble started again. Just, you know, so the only way you can do that is by to bring people together, resolve their problems, and then put the argument forward. This is why I think we should have a united Ireland, or somebody will say, this is why I think we should maintain the union with Britain. But it's discussion and dialogue. That's what's needed, and that's the only thing that will resolve this. Violence won't resolve. It's I think that's why, you know, well, it certainly is the reason that I'm talking to you today, so is that somebody will listen and maybe make their own minds up.
I see. Actually, on that note, I was going to ask this question anyway, but it kind of fits with what you're saying. One of my guests a couple of weeks ago is a lady named Jo Berry. For anyone who doesn't know, her father was killed in the attempt to kill Margaret Thatcher in 1984 with a bomb. Her father was a fairly high up politician, Anthony Berry. And what she's known for at the moment is the fact that she's formed a relationship and eventually a friendship with a man named Patrick McGee, who was the person, one of the people who planted the bomb, but the main one. They do speaking tours and so on. This is purely hypothetical. I'm not trying to like set it up or anything. But if like one of the men from that night came forward and said, listen, I want to come clean and talk talk about this, and I regret what I'm doing and so on. Would you be in any way open to like doing a Joe Berry on it and meeting like a person, meeting, speaking with, attempting to understand someone who intended to kill you or almost.
Well, I've done that. Two things. I know Jo Berry very well. She's an incredibly brave lady, and I remember I met Jo and Pat in I was speaking in Amsterdam, and I met them both, and I listened to them. She's a remarkable lady. There are. You know, but it's actually it's interesting to see them talking together. Now there's no personal relationship there, you know, there between them. There is Joe has made a real attempt to, you know, to understand what has happened. But Patrick McGee has said in the past, you know, I'm sorry your father was killed, but I'm not sorry I killed him. You know, so this is the difficulty that arises, because there's a, you know, it's ideology versus, you know, a personal thing that, you know, there is a conflict there. And these are the things that need to be talked out, and they need to be. I have met, you saw on the Netflix documentary, I sat down with representatives of the UVF. And what you didn't see in the documentary when you watched that is that, you know, there were other people there, not on camera, that were making sure that this was, you know, this was going to go a certain way. We were very, very lucky insofar as that the director and the producer of the documentary obviously were there, and they weren't going to allow the conversation. They weren't going to allow this opportunity that we had decided to take together. DVF and myself, that weren't going to allow it to be hijacked and to be used in some way as a sort of a propaganda mechanism. The integrity of the director Stuart Sender and Alexander Orton, Ali Orton, you know, that ensured that this wasn't going to be sensational, it wasn't going to be anything like that. But the lead up to that was very, very, very cautious, because the UVF didn't, well, clearly they don't get good press. That's, you know, that's a bit of an understatement. So they're suspicious of the media. And of course there was an attempt, you know, to put their own slant on it. But if you watch the documentary, I closed down that argument straight away when I said to Winston, you know, look, I wouldn't agree with you there, but you know, let's see if we can talk about something else. If we can see what we can do in the future. I think it was an opportunity missed by the Irish government, and certainly by the Irish government and the British government, because we had, you know, it successfully, you know, started a conversation, and it was a very public conversation, that we would see what we could do to maybe, you know, you're never going to, you know, give closure to but maybe to improve things and to improve, as I keep going back to, an understanding between people. And that may have led on to something else, maybe between Republicans and their victims, whatever. But we started a process there, but it wasn't followed through. And that, I think, was a missed opportunity. But I do believe that it's a difficult process to start. But what you were saying, you know, did I ever sit down with them? I did. If you look at the book, there's a section in the book called The Craftsman, which is the second in command of the UVF. And it took quite a bit of maneuvering to have a meeting with him. I had a meeting with him in the bowels of a Presbyterian church in Belfast, you know, a secret meeting. And it was supposed to last for 20 minutes, half an hour, where he would give an opinion and all of this type of thing. And it actually lasted for 5 hours. So if you read the book, the Miami Chauvin Massacre, A Survivor's Search for the Truth, that I wrote with my friend Neil Featherston Hall, you can see that on my website is stephentravers.org. But so sure, I think that it's important, and I have done it, and I think that it's very worthwhile to talk to these people. Now, I've never been able to hate them, so maybe that helps. There was a while there when I thought that maybe there was something missing, you know, that I just didn't have this hatred. Even from the moment I woke up in hospital, I didn't even dislike them. I disliked what they did, and I hated what they did. But I never hated the individuals. So I was able to engage with them, and I still am able to engage with them. And channels aren't cut off. So what? As I say, it's not about me anymore. Eugene really thinks it's not about him anymore. It's not about Joe anymore. It's not about any of the people that work with TARP. It's about what's best and how we can avoid this thing in the future. But that doesn't say that, you know, that we will never ever stop demanding justice. You see, you know, demanding justice, it's not incompatible with reconciliation. They're side by side. Truth and justice, and it can never be justice without truth. But I will continue to do that. And sometimes I'm criticized for it. You know, sometimes I'm criticized by somebody who say, well, why did you sit down with the UVF? Sometimes you're criticized because, you know, why did you sit down with the Republicans? Why did you talk to them? Because they were responsible. And there have been times when, you know, victims, and sometimes high profile victims, will criticize you because they find it, you know, incomprehensible that you can do that. But I think that the fact that, you know, I've always, you know, held the view that, you know, this wasn't for me. It wasn't personal. I was just a pawn in this awful game. Hopefully we can make a difference. You know, I don't have the key to peace and all of the wonderful things that we need to do before we have a successful United Ireland or a successful relationship or whatever way this thing pans out. But you know, as long as there's integrity there and that we do our best and we don't do it for the wrong reasons, then I will continue to meet them. Yeah.
You touched on something very fascinating there. I'll bring you back to the other mind. You said that during filming of a particular scene in the documentary when you spoke to an ex-UVF person, you said there were those off camera, but they were trying to influence or pervert the interview. No. Do you mean like during when the questions they were cutting in or something?
No, those people weren't trying to influence that. They were just trying to make sure that there was no that there was nothing compromising said, because you know you've got to be very careful when you say, you know, what we were saying there was that the man I spoke to was a representative of the, was speaking for the organization. We're not going to say anything other than that. You see, these are dangerous. It's dangerous to have some of these conversations because there are people that can, you know, use them against you. And I'm fully aware of that. So there's no way that we're going to put anybody in danger. And there were people there that were making sure that something, you know, wasn't, but there was nothing said so nobody had to step in. Nobody had to say anything. And as I say, you know, when there was an attempt, as you'll see in the documentary, to mitigate this and to say the thing was that nobody was supposed to die on that morning, that it was simply to send a message to the South that they could touch anywhere. I closed that down very quickly by saying, without being rude, I just said, forensic reports and show that wasn't the case. It was, you know, we wouldn't have been past Newry when this happened. So, but it didn't progress into that any further. You know, the man agreed with me. Yeah, look, let's talk and see what we can, you know, what we can work out and what we can do to ensure that something like this never happens again. And I you know, people may think it's a bit strange when I say it showed incredible courage on their from them to actually engage with this, because you know, once the filming is done, you're handing it over to somebody then to you know, that they can cut it or and you know and make it look whatever way, you know, sensational headlines. But they didn't. These were filmmakers of the highest integrity, and what they simply did was they showed the truth. You know, there was no bias, and they, when they came across to film with us, they just wanted to be a fly on the wall and to see what, you know, how these engagements were taking place. Of course, having a meeting with we would have liked to have had a meeting with the craftsman on film. That's not to say that he, you know, that we didn't have a meeting with. We would have liked to have a meeting with senior people. We certainly would have liked to have had a meeting with the people who spent time in jail with it, you know. Not to berate them or not to say, you know, you shouldn't have done this or how dare you or anything like that. It's I don't make these films or the podcasts like this for me. I make it for you, John. I make it for all of the people out there. I know the story. I know what happened. I know all of these things. But it's those that, you know, if we do nothing, only start a conversation about this, and that there are some people who would say, you know, I think you're going about this the right way. Well, that's fine. You know, we've been successful with this, and that goes for people who are involved in both sides of the conflict. And I say both sides, but it also includes, you know, security force members, as well, who who did terrible things too. You know, we mustn't forget that they were not honest brokers.
Did it change your perspectives, your perspective on the attacks, when you did then begin to accept that that there was a military involvement, there was British government involvement? Did it just make it a different thing in your mind, or was it an attack was an attack?
It did change my mind, but you know, again, to say change my mind is not exactly accurate, because I had no mind on this. I had no view on it. I didn't want to have a view on this. I didn't want to know about collusion. I didn't want to know about these things. I looked at Britain and I said, you know, that's where the Beatles came from. This is my favorite group, or the Rolling Stones, or the Kings of the Animals, or any of these bands. That's what I wanted Britain to be. But, you know, we live in, sometimes we can't continue to live in this sort of fairy tale bubble that, you know, that the world is a utopia. It isn't like that. You know, terrible things are done by people, you know, that you're not. There's a case in Britain there recently where a nurse was killing babies. I don't know if you read that. It was terrible. So, you know, because we're inclined to have this sort of one view of some, put people in little categories and pigeonholes, and this is a policeman, he wouldn't do anything. This is a nurse, who wouldn't do anything. This is a musician that wouldn't know anything other than how to play a bass guitar or something like that. But, you know, individuals are fascinating creatures, you know, it's interesting to get inside the mind of these people so that we can understand ourselves. I went through, you know, I didn't realize that I had been as badly damaged psychologically as I am. PTSD is a terrible thing, but at the time of the incident, and at the time when I was supposed to be getting better and being assessed by a psychologist, psychiatrist, people, you know, I thought I'm being assessed because there's some kind of a claim for, you know, some kind of a legal claim that I wanted to get the money back for my guitar that was melted on the night or something like that. You know, I wanted, this is the only reason I thought I was, you know, I was being assessed or getting a psychiatric report. Now, years afterwards, for over 48 years afterwards, I realize how important it is to have these things, because the damage that it does to people psychologically, I never understood what enduring personality meant. Enduring personality change is, you know, I didn't know. I never heard that term before, about, say, 6 or 7 years ago when we were going through the court process that we had to have. And then I never knew what imposter syndrome was and things like that. And it's because you now understand these things that you look back and you say, the mistakes I made in my life, or the, you know, the things that I said and did and how I felt, this is the reason that I did that. So understanding what happened is one thing. Understanding yourself is very, very valuable as well, to understand why you did and why you thought certain things and why. But one thing I can't understand is that I lacked the ability to hate. Perhaps it's just a good thing.
Yeah, I was going to say that did fascinate me when you told me. I think it's, especially being a young man, I think it would be like the initial instinct of most young men to want to kill him, or to think about doing it, even if they were someone who never dealt in violence or killing or anything like that.
Well, I suppose as part of being a musician and an entertainer in some way, I mean, I was a bass player. I never wanted to be in the limelight. And the bass player's job was to hold down the rhythm, to form a groove. That's the nature of the instrument. But it's in every entertainer that when you walk on stage, you hope the audience likes you. You know, you hope the... In the cases of Miami, it was like, it's the first time that I ever really saw genuine love coming up. And I wanted, I suppose, you know, I just I just wanted the whole world to love you. And so I was inclined to think, you know, well, they do, you know, I'm wrong about this. There isn't a, these people, they didn't mean it. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, even the week after it happened, while I was still in the hospital, I had this idea that they would have gone home that morning and said, what in the name of God did we just do? I believed that for years, you know. And then when I started to read reports about Jackson killing, even the following day, I'm not sure it was the following day or a couple of days afterwards, they weren't sorry. You know, I saw people sort of being nice in the dock and when they were in court. And once they were sentenced, you know, they just looked at the court, put their hand up and said, no surrender, you know. See, you think to yourselves, you know, who can you believe, you know, or do we simply want to believe the best in people? And in a way, I'm glad to say that, yeah, I do. I just want to see the best in people.
It's very interesting. Thank you very much for everything you shared. I won't keep you too much longer. Everything you told us now is greatly appreciated. As serious personal insight. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with? Just any kind of final thoughts or parting words?
I hope people give it serious consideration. You know, whether or not they agree with you or agree with you, you know, what you said, just. The best thing we ever did was to listen to one another. You know, that's the best thing. So if you're driving along in a car down some highway in America and you're listening to this, you know, just give it some thought. I may not be right. You may not agree. You may agree. But unless we give these things, and they are problems, you know, just give them serious thought. I'm currently writing the new book. It's called... And it's more a personal book than the last one. And it's something similar to what we've spoken about, you know, understanding how you feel, how you think, how things impact on you, and how you can use your experience to help other people so that they won't have that kind of experience. It's actually called The Bass Player. So, because at this stage, you know, anybody could write a book about the Miami Showland incident. You could get an AI to do it in 10 minutes, you know. But there's so much information out there. There's also, you know, popular misconceptions, and there are also there's misinformation, disinformation, whatever. So the new book is, and I hope to be in America. There's a young man in New York called Paul. Paul is, and maybe I'll send you details for him so that you can get in touch with him. But I'll be doing and Paul Finnegan, I'll be doing a speaking tour, I think, in the springtime. I'm sure I'll be in New York.
Oh, very good. Yeah, I'll most certainly come to it. I'd love to. Yeah, send me Paul's details to you. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, best of luck.
Stephen, thank you very much for everything. Bye. Like I said, now everything you shared, I greatly appreciate it. And thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome, John.